There's an assumption that somehow the state, with its coercive power, can force an outcome where you create a safe internet for kids, 100%. And that's a faulty assumption, I think. The internet is not safe insofar as that you're not going to get like zero exposure to any of these things that you're worried about.
We would use things that would reroute the DNS. This used to be a big thing before VPNs. Yeah. And then you could trick it so you could get to whatever website you wanted.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to CultureScape, the show that interviews the geek creators and influencers that built nerd culture. I'm your host, Peter Pischke, and we have a mind-blowing show for you today. Have you seen the latest deepfake video of Morgan Freeman saying outrageous things? Did you hear the new Drake song that was actually written by an AI? Or perhaps you've read a terrible, awful, downright bad news article that you later find out was generated by ChatGPT-3? Yes, these are just some examples of how generative artificial intelligence is changing the way we create, consume, and take apart art, literature, music, computer programming, and so much more. With just a few keystrokes, anyone with an internet connection can generate amazing and realistic content using programs like ChatGPT-3 or Google Bard in seconds. It's an amazing time to be alive, and as a disabled guy, I can tell you AI has opened up a lot of possibilities, opportunities for me that otherwise I probably wouldn't be able to do, including my work as a reporter and, you know, the show right here. With all the positives, AI does have many challenges and controversies as well. There are many concerns about how the impact of AI on our rights, our privacy, our culture, issues about artistic identity, copyright, and plagiarism. So despite all the positives, there are many in news and tech, education and law, politics and elsewhere that are trying to take that genie and put it back in the bottle. To help us navigate this complex and fascinating world, I'm thrilled to have James Trinowski with us today. James writes about tech and is a senior technology innovation and policy analyst at Americans for Prosperity. He has written extensively in newspapers and elsewhere about how AI is transforming our world. So he's going to walk us through the future of AI, what is happening in the halls of places like Congress, you know, what's happening in the world of education, etc. He's going to tell us, you know, what is this? Is this a really good thing? AI good? AI bad? And I'm sure he's going to correct me when I inevitably say something stupid or wrong about AI. So this should be a fun episode. And welcome to the show, James. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Hey, let me start here with this story. This is a good place to start. I was attending a friend's graduation party. So their kid graduated from high school at the open house. That's what we call them up here in the Midwest. We do. I don't. When I lived on the East Coast, they don't do the graduation open houses. So I guess it's more up here. Anyways, so I was sitting down and I was sitting down next to a guy and we got to talk and he was a teacher for my local school district. And when we were talking about, you know, has the school district, have you been informed about what is happening with AI and how it's affecting things like taking tests, writing essays, etc. He had told me that actually the school district had done nothing on it. In fact, they told them, don't worry about it. It will be made illegal any day. And I'm not the biggest expert. I was like, that seems unlikely. Am I wrong?
That would certainly be news to me if AI became blanketly illegal in the next few days. I don't think I've seen those proposals just yet. But you know, with respect to schools, when you're talking about the challenges with AI, that was certainly one of the most immediate things that got highlighted is, well, now kids can go and cheat on their exams and all of that, which, you know, I guess there's some validity to that. But I would also say that when we're talking about AI in that context, the fun thing about it is that there's other technology that grows up tangentially with it that's meant to like help with identifying things that might be like that, just like you have the plagiarizing software that you can go and run through to see whether or not something might have been plagiarized. You would probably have a similar software developed to go and be like, was this written by a predictive text software like ChatGPT? It looks like there's a 70-some-odd% chance. But even on the flip side, even if that wasn't the case too, I still do think that there's the other funny reality of this where kids, as bright as they are for knowing to go to ChatGPT to try to solve some of these issues, they're not very good about hiding their tracks. So like we've seen numerous examples of kids going and
having their homework submitted to teachers where they left a ChatGPT prompt on there. Not very good cheating if you're going to be doing it. So I think that there's going to be ways that, you know, AI will have some challenges, but I also think that it opens up opportunities for schools to look at how they can better leverage that technology to inform the learning environment that they're providing for students. We've had one kind of education system for so long, and AI offers a truly disruptive force, I think, that can hopefully prove to be net positive for students, especially when they've had so much generational learning loss during the pandemic as a result of the lockdown. So I think that there's actually an enormous potential there with AI.
I see the potential for AI, and maybe I'm an optimist. I'm hardly an optimist in anything else, but for AI, I'm very optimistic for what it's capable of doing. I used to work in education, so I think about the weaknesses there, the problems are there, and I feel like, wow, you know, this could be a tool in the future that could really help, you know, teach to the individual kid. It could help them to understand the back and forth better of education better, because, you know, there's only one teacher to a classroom, and sometimes the teacher might not click with a student, but with AI, you know, potentially in the future, and even now, you know, they could have the best teacher they would ever have, and it could be right there, and it could answer them questions whenever they need to. So I'm amazed by all that stuff. But what amazes me even more, though, is talking to people and how, and this not to be rude to them, but how blind they are to the generative AI, to like all these programs and what they can do. And it's not just an education. I hear it, you know, I'm talking to some friends, they're in the SD legislature out here. It's very similar. People, for whatever reason, seem to not really think about like what this is going to do to their individual industries. But maybe that's just local. You write national. So tell me what you hear. What do you think is the current landscape of AI where people's heads are at?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think it's one that everybody's still trying to wade through, frankly. I think that that's the collective conversation that we're seeing on the national level is, you know, what should we be doing about AI? What does good look like in this space? What is the role of government? And to be honest, I think there's a lot more questions than answers right now because there's just not a common understanding of, number one, what is AI? Like, I think we know, broadly speaking, what it is. But when you're trying to define that legally, it's pretty important because there are some definitions, let's say, that might be out there in proposals that might be so broad that they'll actually capture a lot of existing internal business-to-business purposes of AI that are actually very helpful for streamlining processes. And if you have that over-encompassing definition, that might be a little problematic. So I think that there's that aspect of it for sure. I think then to your point, which I've certainly experienced talking with state legislators as well as the federal offices, I think that there is a lack of understanding in terms of this technology about what it is, what it is not, more importantly, what it can, what it cannot do, you know, where the right role of government is right now. And I think that, you know, again, that's broadly where we're seeing the landscape right now. It's a lot of high level conversation. So we've seen everything from, you know, revoking any kind of Section 230 protections for AI, which is, I think, an open debate, legally speaking, as to whether or not that would actually apply to generative AI. That's something that we'd have to see unfold. But we've also seen other proposals like blue tape commissions to go and form, you know, bipartisan bodies to offer, you know, potential solutions as to what regulations around AI should look like. So you're kind of seeing like everybody wade through the waters, I think, at a very surface level by design almost. You've seen some companies obviously put forward proposals. Microsoft has put forward their own proposal for regulating AI. OpenAI itself as a company, which Microsoft has supported, has also had its own version of AI regulations that it supported. The EU has passed its own AI regulations. We know China is looking at AI and how it wants to go and execute in that technology. So there's a lot of competing factors basically right now when we're looking at AI that I think that has everybody thinking, thankfully, you know, pretty seriously about some of these other implications and getting it right, because getting it right is so, so critical for U.S. Leadership in this space.
I agree. I have this, maybe it's because I'm libertarian like you, but I'm just so ready for someone to really screw this up somehow. I'm just like, someone is going to do something. Some law is going to be passed. There'll be some executive order. Something dumb is going to happen and make everything worse. And I think that's too bad. You know, even for this show, when I'm putting together art assets or I'm trying to figure things out with scripts, these programs are amazingly helpful. They can give you input or insight. They can help you meet like basic standards or hear something from a different point of view. I'm very grateful for them. And but there are people even in our industry, and you consider yourself more a writer than a journalist, where they just want a ban. They just want outright ban. And you could see something like this going on with the writer's strike and the actor's strike, you know, the WAG and SAG.
Yep.
There's a feeling from a lot of people, this is all bad. It's horrible. It should be banned. We should be pushed away from society. And I'm like, actually, no, I kind of like it. Like, there are issues here. We need to deal with, like, copyrights. We need to deal with plagiarism, even copyright law, which there are some issues there I'm sure you're aware of. But I'm a positive person. Why do you think the national conversation seems to lean more towards the negative? Is that because these are established institutions and industries and they just don't want the change? Or is it something more than that?
I think that's a great question. And I think that honestly, it's not as surprising as perhaps you would think, insofar as that I think this comes up every single time that you have something new and fancy to go and do it. And honestly, there's also a cycle of moral panics that kicks in with these transformational technologies. We saw something similar with social media. We've seen something similar with video games. We've seen something similar with the car, with radio. It's nothing new, at least from a historical perspective, that there's going to be reticence to taking on something that's, you know, so new in society for a variety of reasons. So that's nothing surprising per se. I think that there's also a degree of it's easier in some ways, I think, to just be a no man on a lot of this, to be hypercritical and wanting to prevent the introduction of this because you're worried about so many effects. I can understand that. You referenced the writer's strike, because they're worried about copyrights and they're worried about, you know, AI being used to go and, you know, basically take their copyrighted work and, iterate that for something else. I can understand those concerns to some degree. And I think that what's important to recognize, too, though, is that that same tool can also help you become a lot more creative in different ways and help you think through how you might want to, you know, adjust things on the fly. It's going to actually streamline your production. Maybe it'll make it so you're not spending, you know, so much time having to go and produce that manuscript as you might have had to in the past because you've been working with AI to kind of like, you know, jog your writer's block, if you will, right? I know that personally, I've used AI to go and actually help with my research and writing. So that way I can better understand what are the kinds of questions that I'm seeking answers to. And I think that for writers, it can be a similar kind of thing. For actors, it can be a similar kind of tool that can help them think through, you know, what is a good idea. Indiana Jones, from my understanding, when that latest movie that was just released, they did like a young version of Harrison Ford.
Yes.
Basically like used AI to superimpose young Harrison Ford onto old Harrison Ford, which is kind of amazing. I think that opens up a lot of opportunities for actors too. So, again, I don't think it's all down and negative. I think that's wrong. I know that there was like, I think my favorite one of those was that there was a letter that was signed by over 350 people and organizations that was likening, taking the risks of AI similarly to pandemics and nuclear warfare. I'm like, well, that's a pretty broad range. And I'm pretty sure you could remove artificial intelligence and insert a lot of other technologies and probably have a similar kind of outset of support for something like that. It's a very broad statement. It doesn't really mean much in the scheme of things when you're putting it on that kind of level. And it's a little hyperbolic. So it's not actually good for advancing the necessary conversations that we want to be having.
I agree. It is tough because I know, especially if you're artistic, if you're intellectual, and this I think is really the key thing why this issue has been so divisive is because there was an expectation, even when I was in J school, they're like, AI, it'll happen someday. But don't worry, we're going to be okay. It's going to be all the blue-collar people. They're the ones that are going to, you know, they need to go learn to code. They're going to be the ones out of the job. But actually, it turns out AI is really good at white-collar work, like really, really good at it. I do seriously wonder how much of this is just people, you know, feeling threatened, like, oh, my job is online. Because I know I feel it sometimes, too. You know, we have news sites now that are being pretty open about how they're experimenting with AI, is putting out articles and listicles and collating data and feeds. It's like basic work that used to be like something like a person that was starting an intern to do. Like now that's gone. And so you have to ask the question, okay, well, is there going to be a different job that a new person could come in, or we're just not going to have that? What does that mean? I think there are legitimate issues, but I don't know. What do you? I'd love to hear what you say. So go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that the labor point is obviously the biggest aspect of this conversation that I think it certainly is fair to want to have it. For techno optimists like myself and for people that are free market oriented, the notion of just job destruction, job creation, it's a little bit of mythical in the sense of there's no like, net loss. It's not just there's absolute jobs lost and absolute jobs gained. And it doesn't just happen like at a snap of a finger. It's something that's a little bit more modular. It takes time. When you see the job losses occur, where they get relocated to, what those jobs might look like are different, and the people that have the skills to fill those jobs. So I think that there's a valid conversation in terms of wanting to think through what are the downsides of that effect in terms of labor force. That certainly is one of the big ones that get flagged. But I also think that it's a massive opportunity for reskilling people and also for preparing our future generations to better leverage this technology for themselves. So to your point about white collar work, absolutely. I think it's going to do a phenomenal job of basically dealing with those redundant tasks that you have to normally do at a particular job. Lawyers that have to go and spend time reading contracts for typos and whatever. Like, I think that, AI can do a phenomenal job of sifting through those very quickly and dealing with that. But at the same time, that is a new skill set in and of itself. So I think that opens up a new kind of job. So I think that it's not as clear as people think. Yes, there are going to be job implications here. There will be some jobs lost, undoubtedly, but there will also be new jobs created and there will be new skills opportunities available for people. So I think that it's very important when we're thinking about that conversation about what we can do to kind of bridge the gap and smooth that out. So that way we're not just having a bunch of people, lose jobs en masse and then not really have a good, second option to come out of that. So I think that, again, it's just about identifying those skills that we can go and help people develop from that, and really rejiggering a lot of our stuff to support that. Like with education stuff that we were talking about before, there's a great opportunity there to integrate education with AI, so that way people can become comfortable and familiar with the tool. More importantly, being more comfortable and familiar with the tool and its limitations, because if that is what you're able to get out of it, that's actually really valuable, because then you can go and offer the insight of, well, here's what the bot is telling us, but here's what's actually wrong, and here's where we can go and adjust on the margins, right? And I think that that's really where we should be focusing on the future.
Agree. You follow legislation, what's happening at the state level and national quite a bit. What are some positive things you're seeing in the legislative world that gives you hope, and what are some like really bad ones? What are the ones for you to grit your teeth like?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, it's thankfully been relatively quiet-ish. There's been some activity around this when it comes to state and federal level action. The federal proposals, like I said, on one end, they're trying to go and like blatantly remove Section 230 liability protections. That's not really an AI piece of legislation. That's a different kind of thing in my view. But at the state level, you're certainly seeing some things. New York has some stuff that they did where they wanted to go and have regulation that was saying, hey, you can't discriminate against people with AI, which as a general rule is not wrong or bad per se, like if it's against a protected characteristic or something. But then it extends with a lot of hefty fines and other kinds of things that are attached to it. So it's like, you took something that was relatively benign and you made it a lot more worse unnecessarily. I would say one of the other proposals that's not great that I've seen is like, there was a similar federal proposal a while back called like the Honest Ads Act that was trying to deal with how advertising was getting done online. And then the RNC this year had used AI to create an ad about Joe Biden's second term, should he win. Using 100% artificial intelligence to do it. And they didn't hide the ball there. They kind of bragged about it, which, I mean, why not? Kind of cool. There was this lawmaker that proposed a bill shortly thereafter that was seeking to basically, target that and mandate disclosure of the use. I think that the problem with the proposals right now is that it's a little short-sighted insofar that if they tend to circulate around disclosure, transparency, making certain kinds of mandates, or they have overly broad definitions of AI, where I do have hope about this in general is I think that, again, the United States is not being rushed to go and put out something in terms of like hard law constraints. And I think that that's a net positive. The EU, by comparison, has already passed their AI framework. And I would be willing to bet some serious money that the European Union is not going to be a place of major innovation in artificial intelligence by comparison to the United States because of the kinds of onerous regimes that they have there. So I think that that's the kind of stuff that gives me hope, is that we're at least on a pathway where we can go and get something right. And I think that, I guess the one thing that I will also mention is there's a little bit of a recognition that does give me hope, where I think lawmakers realize some of them will go and cast it as that AI is operating in the Wild West and that there needs to be new rules for it. But that's actually not necessarily true. There's a lot of existing rules on the books. You don't have to go and rewrite them every single time a new piece of technology comes up. It's about understanding how the technology works and enforcing those laws. So I think that as people get more familiar with understanding the technology, then they will be better informed to enforce existing laws against misuses of that technology that violate existing law. So I think that there's definitely some good things, there's some bad, but broadly speaking, I do think that the United States is trying to trend in the right direction here.
One of the interesting things that made me a little concerned, that this came up late last week, so what, July 15th? It was Adobe, and they were talking to Congress, and they wanted to encourage the government to adopt use of their meta text. They had a tag they developed for projects. So basically, you could identify artwork that had been made by AI, basically. And they had support in it from the Department of Defense. DARPA had chimed in at one point. It was stuff like that that made me like,
yeah.
I feel like AI was like so great. And it could go either way.
Yeah.
You are right, though, that so far it's gone a lot better than maybe I would have predicted at the start of this. Like, when I was really starting to pay attention was last year, October. And I wouldn't have predicted it's gone this as well as it has.
Yeah. I would say, as like a general point of order, like, it always makes me feel uneasy whenever a company is like going and trying to pitch something to the government to use their technology. Just inherently, just makes me feel very uneasy. I'm used to a lot of conversations at the state level about government use of technology for surveillance purposes. So for me, whenever I think about that, I'm just like, yeah, I don't want to encourage that. I would like to discourage any financial ties between the government and businesses, and that relationship. I do not want to see, you know, developed any further than it already is in many cases. So that's just the general point with respect to that. But no, I think, I don't disagree with you. I do think that on average, the United States is going better. I would say that, you know, more often than not, it's just like there's these fantastical headlines that always capture the news in some way or another that makes people want to feel the urge to, you know, do something. And I think that that's a wrong instinct. Like, there's nothing wrong with inherently wanting to do something to tackle an issue. The problem is, you know, what is that response to that demand, right? What is the proposal that comes from it? And more often than not, what we see is that there are proposals that don't meet the moment in that respect. I think that that puts us in a worse off spot. It means that we're not having the necessary and right conversations that we should be having. And it just, you know, further delays. And meanwhile, China's just, you know, chugging along, investing its state capital into AI. And we know what its vision is. They want to go and lead in AI. They do. It means a much different look for the internet, more broadly speaking, in 10, 15 years, that I think people would be comfortable with.
I agree. One of the interesting things that's come out from all this AI discussion is there was a paper. It was leaked. It was by Google. And they were talking about what would be the big competitor if Google comes out, and they did eventually with Bard, comes out with their own AI program. Who is the big competitor? And it surprised some people because they didn't say their biggest competitor was OpenAI, though they said they were one of them. They said the biggest competitor that would beat both of them, of course, is the open source community. Just like everyone training that information, which is such a fascinating, that's such a fascinating thing. That's such a change from what the internet has been so far.
Yeah, no, it is. And I think that it's actually one of my favorite things when you see Google and OpenAI and Microsoft recognize this. The open source community is probably one of the biggest disruptors in and of itself, because It's a lot more faster responding, I think, to user needs, and it can move very fast and it's very nimble. Whereas like Microsoft and Google are by design very slow. One of the problems for Google explicitly with AI was the fact that they were extraordinarily slow with their rollout for Bard. And then even when they felt pressured to go and release it because of, OpenAI's ChatGPT becoming like a world phenomenon, it was not like a polished product. It was something that left a lot to be desired. And I think that it goes to show, like, there's this, a lot of my work in tech always revolves around this tech lash, right? There's obviously a lot of animosity towards the big tech companies themselves. And often what ends up happening is that there's this assumption that these companies are going to be here for the test of time, that Meta is going to be here and Google is going to be here, that there are these, you know, quote unquote monopolies. And I'm like, there's actually not much to indicate that that's exactly true. The only way that that is going to happen for any of these companies is if you pass legislation that makes it so that they can actually have a moat. So like back when, you know, Meta was asking for 230 reforms, it's like, do you think it's because they, you know, why do you think they're asking for it? They can afford the compliance costs, and then they can go and throw up their hands and point to the government regulation and be like, not us, it's them. So I think that, you know, for these companies, they don't actually stand the test of time. Google, there's a very real threat there. For Meta, they want to go and get involved in this because it makes sense for them. Facebook as a product within Meta's portfolio has a legitimate problem with getting younger users to use the platform in a profitable way. That's been documented for some time now. And I think that, you know, again, they need some other kind of product line to develop to support their business if they're going to continue to be the firm that we understand and know, which ultimately undergirds my whole thesis about the tech industry, is that it is a very hyper-competitive industry where the mantra and the dictate to the companies is innovate or become irrelevant. So, you know, I think that that's the coolest thing that comes out of seeing this conversation with AI unfold, watching all these companies that have their established positions realize just how fragile it actually is.
That is a great point, because this is something people in journalism are learning right now, especially entertainment journalism. I'm coming out with an article tomorrow. We're going to publish with Clownfish TV. And I got to talk to one of these guys that heads one of these big independent entertainment news websites. They've been very successful. But he basically said in a year from now, most major entertainment news websites, as we know them, are going to be dead. And his point was like, MP said, people are blaming all the wrong things. They want to blame politics. They want to blame wokeness. Or they want to blame AI. That's one of the things he mentioned. He says, all that is hogwash. He says, the thing that's killing news right now is the inability for them to get readers, and that Facebook and Google in particular used to feed people, used to take people and feed them to their articles, and now they just do that for themselves. And it's that change alone that has caused this huge amount of pain and change in this industry, which is interesting because we do have an example of a country that is trying to deal with this, which is Canada. But the reaction is, it's quite unique. I don't know quite what to make of the situation going on with Canada wanting Google to pay journalism, and so that Google and Facebook are like, okay, then no Facebook for you. You can't have it, Canada.
I mean, I'm all here for it. That particular proposal, which started in Australia, actually, was basically requiring what would be called a link tax, which is, you know, if you're Facebook, if you're Google or whatever, that you would have to allow for the display of the link on your website. But if like a news organization's link was shared on your profile, on their website, rather, you know, you would have to go and pay that news organization out of a bundle of cash. Some percentage for that link, right? So therefore the term becomes a link tax. We've seen similar proposals here in the United States. Obviously Canada's trying to do it. They did pass it. The problem that I have with those particularized things is that it also fails to recognize the symbiotic relationship between newsrooms and social media platforms. For Meta, they're not necessarily making money off of like the notion of links being shared on there per se. It's just the engagement that really is where the matter is for them. But for the news orgs, that link being shared is massively valuable, because now all of a sudden you have millions of people in Facebook's case, billions of people that are able to go and potentially see that link, that are able to go and see your story and click through to it. That actually generates ad revenue for the newspaper companies on the other side. And, you know, I think the problem with these proposals is that, again, it doesn't recognize that symbiotic relationship, one. And then two, it's treating the companies themselves as a cash cow, assuming, again, wrongly in my view, that these companies are going to be able to stand the test of time and just afford to keep footing the bill. When it comes to the local journalism point, the thing that I usually say about it, because this is the genesis for why you see these proposals being put forward, they like to claim that local journalism is dying and that we must do something to save local journalism. Again, to do something. The problem here is that I would actually offer that there's a different problem that's emerging, where when you take every single imaginable issue that impacts a state or local community and make it a federal issue by some rhyme or reason, you're actually taking away an issue that the state would otherwise be working on, that local newspaper would then be covering, connecting with their local communities and actually informing them to be a better user or a better, you know, citizen in that case. So I think that there's actually a lot of mitigating factors here that are not being properly accounted for. And for those reasons, I think that it's very clear as to why you should be opposed to a link tax like that. You know, the California had one that they were considering. They tabled it for the year, thankfully. But at one point, it gets the capture on this thing becomes so clear. Like, there was an amendment in California, if memory serves right, that wanted to go and dictate to the news publishing companies that got money out of that program in terms of how they were going to go and spend it on newsrooms, et cetera. And, you know, again, that's just very prescriptive. I think that we need to focus on empowering, you know, these media outlets to be able to better innovate in this space. They've been stuck in a very one-size-fits-all model for the last 100 years. And, you know, I think that they could really stand to go and adopt and change with the times and be a little bit more flexible. Pretending that if we just give them, you know, cash, goes and fixes it, doesn't actually do that.
Yeah. I was thinking something similar in California was the EB-5, which was to mess with contracting or freelancing.
Yeah,
and that just makes everything harder. It's much easier to screw up something or to push something in the fragile relationship between a contractor and the person hiring them. And that's kind of what happened there. And I'm kind of thinking that's what's going to happen with Canada. This is not dissimilar, but what's going on with news and what we've seen things like in like the tobacco settlements or now the opioid settlements, people are like, well, they get these big companies and they shake them down and then we have all this money. And, you know, it's like the old Simpsons meme. It's like step one, step two, step three, lots of money. It's kind of like that. We're like, well, you could take these companies for a huge lawsuit, yes, and they may pay out a huge amount of money, but that doesn't mean that money actually gets to the people who could actually use it. What happens is generally it goes to one of these states, and then the treasurer decides who gets to go to it. They may just so happen, I don't know, just total coincidence that they're friends and they own a large company. That's the kind of thing that happens with news. It's like to fix that relationship, they'd have to have a time machine. You can't just like go to the government and say, take all this big wad of money and now give it to all the right people. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it also ignores the rise of this issue that comes with these particular proposals of defining journalism. I'm not really sure that the government should be in the position of trying to define what journalism is. That is, you know, in its own right, a kind of speech that is being done. And I don't think that you want the government playing that role. And again, if it's the government that's controlling the string as to who gets to be defined as a journalist, I think that creates potentially some perverse incentives if you were to go and operate outside of the accepted view. If you're a little bit more of a heterodox thinker, all of a sudden, you know, maybe your organization might not be considered for the pot of the pie, if you will. I think that there's definitely a lot of concerns that I have just with the natural notion of the government trying to define what is something that is quite literally baked in there in the Constitution. You know, we're talking about freedom of the press. Like, I don't think that you want to, I think you're actually taking away some freedom from them in some ways if you're tying them to, you know, state guaranteed money.
Yep. Because if they're giving you a check, they expect something in return. They may not say it.
Yeah.
But there is an expectation.
Yeah.
It's just like, look, do you like the idea of the government paying for InfoWars? Does that make sense to you? Do you want like that one weird Facebook troll guy that's you know, a little too obsessed with like Onanism? Do you want him to get money from government? Like, what is the plan here? And you're like, no, I just want it for the people I like and for the things I like. Well, yeah, maybe, but it would also have to be for everyone else. Or it ends up being like the PPP loans. I mean, and that's just a total grip. Whoever gets that money has no reflection on reality whatsoever.
Yeah, kind of to your point on the PPP thing, like part of the issue lied in the applications for it were so complex that only the very large companies that had the lawyers on staff to navigate it could have possibly have gotten the PPP loans correctly filled out and executed in time to get that money, right? And I think the same thing would happen here with newsrooms. It's like the biggest ones that have the lawyers to sift through whatever the requirements are and the application process, et cetera, they would be perfectly fine. And that's usually one of the biggest points that we make about these link tax bills is that you talk about wanting to save local journalism, but I can't help but notice that you're also helping fund, you know, major outlets basically, padding their bottom line here because they're the ones who can afford to navigate it. So, like I said, I think that there's a lot of problems with this notion of a link tax. I think that, again, there's this massive misunderstanding about the symbiotic nature of the relationship. Honestly, I think from the platform's perspective, when you're talking about how they just shut it off in Canada, it's because there was this misappropriation of value for the company. And that is what Facebook and Google are telling Canada. They're saying, hey, I know you think local journalism is important, and we think it is too, but it is not valuable to us as a business. Like, if we had to put a price on it, it is not worth what you are trying to force us to pay, and we will not be held hostage to pay whatever it is that you're looking at here in terms of the, you know, this proposal, right? So, you know, they had every right to go and basically take down link sharing inside Canada, and I don't blame them. And, you know, I know that people think that it's bullying, and I'm like, well, at some point, companies have to draw a line in the sand. The government's trying to hold them hostage to go and make them do something that they otherwise might not want to do. And they have their own interests. They have to be willing to do it. They've been getting walked over by the world, basically, for the last several years for a variety of reasons. You know, and they're trying to acquiesce and make everybody happy. And the reality is that they've made nobody happy. At some point, you just got to put your foot in the ground and stand for yourself and your values and for what it is that you're trying to do and clearly articulate what your issues are. And, you know, that's what you're starting to see the companies do. And honestly, good for them.
I would like to bring up so the social media laws, because I know you're in on that, and the tech itself. Since you work, though, in the policy side, do you ever get to interact with people, you know, congressmen, senators, any of the people in, like, D.C.? Do you have a good, because when I watch, when they bring Zuckerberg, or they brought Jack Dorsey back when he was in charge of Twitter, and they bring him down to the Hill, and they get the senator to come up, and they have some just ridiculous question. It's like, this hasn't been true since Windows 98 type situation. Do you counter any of that in your work? Like, how informed are the people, the policymakers that you speak with on a personal and professional level?
Yeah, I would say in terms of like talking with actual legislators, if I'm being honest, the relationships that I have are actually stronger with state legislators. They're just more readily available. They don't have the support staff, so they're often looking to organizations like Americans for Prosperity or others to go and help, you know, educate them about a particular issue and understand what are the trade-offs involved in policy conversations. And they do that with lots of orgs, not just AFP. So, you know, with state legislators, I mean, I lived in Utah for a couple of years. I knew a lot of the members of the House of, you know, the House of Representatives and the Senate. They're all great people. I thoroughly enjoyed getting to know them better. When it comes to the federal delegation, I mean, I would say that I have not gone and talked to any member of Congress personally. I've usually talked to their staff, and the staff are normally fantastic and driven individuals that want to try to figure out how to do something right. So that's always fun, trying to explain our position, our point of view, and how we look at things and how we would want to see what good looks like, et cetera. That's typically the kind of conversation that I have. And I mean, I only recently met Representative Massey, ironically enough, and I got to see his little debt clock on his lapel, which was awesome. He was a very interesting personality and really nice guy. So, but outside of that, I mean, for the most part, you know, I try to have the conversations where I'm needed. you know, I don't want to take away precious time from members when they're doing other things anyway. So I'm happy to talk with whoever wants to listen to me rant about AI or other topics for any given amount of time.
You, when you were in Utah, I think I was listening to an interview and you said you did talk to the Utah governor. Utah is kind of like ground zero for a lot of these bills and discussions about like how state government should regulate social media and how state government should regulate adult content. And I know those are topics that you've written quite a bit about. In my opinion, I feel like many of them are well-intentioned, but I think ultimately they are going to do more harm than is good. Would you like to speak on some of that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like I said, lived in Utah for a couple of years when I was working at the Libertas Institute, run by Connor Boyack, great guy, wrote those Tuttle Twins books, which are fantastic. You know, it was a pleasure working with them and working on tech policy. When it's stuff that you like working on and they're supportive of, it's always fun because then you're not necessarily dealing with, you know, any comes to blows, if you will. But you know, when that was the case, I got to meet the governor for a ceremonial bill signing. It's something that I worked on. And, you know, it was really cool because you got to go and see like the work that you did go and manifest up to, you know, the governor sitting there doing a ceremonial signing, talking about how he thought it was a great idea. And I think that, you know, that was really cool. On the flip side, as you mentioned, obviously not everything is sunshine and rainbows. You know, Utah is certainly one of the states that has had numerous proposals on social media, though the award for the epicenter of that is certainly in Florida and Texas, which passed the original bills that are currently awaiting being granted cert at the Supreme Court. So we're waiting for that to happen. You know, more often than not, you're not wrong with these proposals. They might be well-intentioned. I think that there's a lot of understandable reasons as to why you're concerned, right? Social media has a lot of bad things on it, you know. Porn is bad, like it's not age appropriate for kids, etc. Again, all things that I can empathize with. I get that. But I think that there's a limitation insofar as that there's an assumption that somehow the state, with its coercive power, can force an outcome where you create a safe internet for kids 100%. And that's a faulty assumption, I think. The internet is not safe insofar as that you're not going to get like zero exposure to any of these things that you're worried about. If it's porn, if it's inappropriate content, et cetera, that it is a daunting task. These platforms, the fact that they're able to go and hide like, you know, ISIS beheading videos and other things from our general eye, child sexual abuse material is one of them too. You don't even see it 99.999% of the time. Is kind of astounding. But it's never going to be completely eradicated, which means that it becomes an issue of education. You got to go and teach kids, you know, about these tools. What are the upsides? Because there are upsides to social media. And I do wish that people would have a more honest conversation about that. I know everybody thinks that it's bad, it's addicting, whatever. But the reality is that social media helps people, young people, Gen Z particularly, feel more included, makes them form better relationships with people. Helps connect you with a sense of community too, which as a gamer, I can certainly appreciate because I felt most connected to people that I was playing games with over the years and got to meet some really phenomenal people as a result of that. And I think that, you know, we need to have that more responsible conversation. That way you can at least understand what are those downsides and how can we better mitigate. And then also connecting with parents better. So that way they can understand what are the tools at their disposal so that they can be empowered to best tailor an online experience for their child. I don't want them to have to, you know, deal with that. But if you go with these blanket bans or age verification things, there's privacy concerns, there's anonymity concerns from a free speech perspective because anonymous speech is protected as well underneath the First Amendment. I think that we have to be cognizant of that. I don't like the notion that we're de-anonymizing the internet, particularly when you know that the government has this nasty little love of wanting to go and do stuff about that once they know that there are known identities. I think that there's a lot to be worked through there. And when it comes to the porn question, where you know, Pornhub is essentially blocked now in Utah because they don't want to comply with the law. All you're doing is encouraging kids to find out about VPNs and circumventing the law. So ironically enough, after Utah passed the law, VPN searches exploded. You know, similar things have happened in other states that have done it. And, you know, that's just the way it's going to be. So I'd rather have the pragmatic conversation than just stick by this, you know, set of super unrealistic ideals. I would rather go and have a practical conversation about things.
When I was a teenager for the public school, they had a very strange block list. I don't know if it's like some very interesting evangelical person got in charge of the block list. I don't know what happened there, but we would use things that would reroute the DNS. This used to be a big thing before VPNs.
Yeah.
And then you could trick it so you could get to whatever website you wanted.
Yeah.
It's just think about that though. The school, but take the bureaucrats at your local school, put that at the national level. That's what you got. It doesn't work. The UK passed a law pushing age verification years ago, and it was basically unenforceable. And it's kind of a good thing it's unenforceable, because if it was enforceable, then do you want the government to have access to, you know, the adult websites you have? Or do you want the government to be able to disparage you? Or someone leaks it, you know? This is going way back. But every now and then you do hear of a story, especially with national politics, where there will be some kind of low-level private citizen. They will do something somebody doesn't like, and then someone will leak records. Like, these are private records. They're like shield in court.
Yep.
But somehow they just get out. I remember Joe the Plumber. This is way back, man. This is during the McCain days. That's kind of what happened there. So it's like, do you want the government to have the capacity to go ahead and do that?
Yeah.
I say the cost isn't worth it. But that's not true for everyone. I know some people even in my church.
That...
And we're Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So lots of Mormons. I'm sure you knew many in Utah.
Yeah.
Some of them do feel like this is okay. This is the right thing to do. This is the okay thing to do. And it's really hard to have that discussion, especially when it's like one side's more secular and they're against it, and then the other side's a bit more religious conservative and they're for it. It's difficult to like break those communication lines. And you're pretty good actually at discussing this stuff. But what are some of the things you hear from people when you talk about these issues? You're like, no, you just don't understand, James. We have to do this. We have to protect the children. How do you respond to all that?
Yeah, you know, I do think it's hard. And I would say the unique challenge that I face is that I'm 29 years old, I'm single, and I do not have children. So it is not beyond the reproach for people to say you don't have kids, therefore you don't understand. And I do get that argument. Do I think it's completely, inbound? Not necessarily. I don't think that should be the threshold under which you should be allowed to have a conversation. Particularly when the proposals that surround those kids also implicate adults. So with age verification laws, it's not just that we're trying to go and verify that you're a kid. It's that, you know, you have to prove that as a negative, which means that everybody has to do it. All of us have to do it. And the only ways that you can do that, for the record, are through government IDs, birth certificates, social security numbers, things of that nature. Hard links, highly sensitive information to you right now during a time when we're also yelling at these companies for the amount of data that they have in general. Seems a little rich to me, if you ask me. I think that, you know, if you're not doing that, by the way, the alternative is facial scans. Not great for what's called age estimation, which, you know, to put it in perspective.
I would fail that. I'm in my low 30s, I'm pretty sure. But like, no, you're not old enough, Peter.
Yeah. Well, I think that the funny thing about age estimation technology is that I think it gets like the bright lines perfectly fine, right? Like if you're clearly under 13, like I think that's not an issue for them. And if you're clearly over 21, that's not an issue. But if you're in those puberty years of like 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, right? Like you could either look younger than you actually are. You could look older than you are. I know that I looked older than I was at 17. So, I mean, it's just one of those things that, again, it's well-intentioned, and it's just, you're not thinking through all the implications here. And when you were doing polling around it, and this is something that I would bring up, it's like, well, hey, look, your proposal says that you want to do X, and there is polling out there that has asked if people are okay with X, and they're saying no. And they're not saying no by small margins, they're saying no by big margins. And your backup plan for, you know, biometrics, that's even worse. Like, if you thought that was going to be any better, nah, it's not. And again, like, it always comes from a place of empathy. So for me, it's always talking about you know, again, the limitations of the proposals themselves, but then also, hey, you know, I get it where you're coming from. I do. You know, I think that here are things that we can do. Like I said, educating kids on the ups and downs of social media, so that way they're better informed. Doing outreach with parents, so that way they can go and understand what tools are available to them. It shouldn't be mandated from the government that the companies have to do this by default. They already have the tools there. And that's something on the companies where they should continue tinkering with how to better display those controls for parents. And I know that Meta's been working on that. I know Apple's been working on that. It's not a silver bullet thing, because every single person, kind of like how they look at the technology, is a little bit different. So what might work for somebody might not work for somebody else. And all this doesn't even include all the third-party apps that are out there that can help you with controlling what your kids can see and or do on their devices. One great rep in Utah, his name is slipping my mind off the top of my head right now, so I feel bad because I actually liked him a lot. But he used to work in the telco industry, and he got it. He was so great about understanding that this is really, really, really silly, especially when you're talking about like the violations aspect of it. Like if a company were in violation, the penalties were substantial. So again, I get it. The only other thing that I try to say is that, you know, I don't think that you want to be trying to bake morality into the law, because that's very subjective. And what happens when it's shoes on the other foot and the morals are not aligned with yours, that might not be so great for you. That's where you have to work on trying to continue building communities and getting those values just implemented organically from the ground up within your community, as opposed to through hard law.
And AI, generative AI, seems like it would be that technology that would actually be good at filtering something like porn. Like, because it would be able to use those samples and the understanding, you know, the connection to be, figure out, you know, what is what and what isn't. And that would overcome a lot of the hurdles. This isn't like a subject I know very well, but I know in the past, the problem with the filters is they're basically just a list of URLs, and that isn't all that helpful. And so the only way they can almost sometimes work is that they just cover every website under this.
Yeah.
It's like all kinds of things get cut off, like Wikipedia, some of those homeschooling programs, like all kinds of weird things. So it's not effective, but I'm like, generative AI could solve a lot of these problems. What are some of the things that you're hopeful about the future, James? You look at the world of AI and policy. Are there certain programs or tech that you're looking forward to what it can accomplish? Are there changes in the culture that make you feel positive? We focus a lot here on the negative, but what are some of the more positive aspects?
Yeah. Oh, man. With AI, I mean, you cannot understate just how transformational the technology is. I think that when you're looking at AI, there isn't going to be a single sector of our economy that won't be impacted in some kind of way, whether it's white collar, whether it's even blue collar stuff. And if it's high end work, it can all go and get impacted by AI. And so just to like cover a couple, healthcare, it's getting used to go and help read radiology scans to better identify cancer. And we've seen improvements in the miss rate declining from like 50% to 30 some odd percent. You've seen it go and analyze patient medical records to help doctors tailor treatment plans for their patients more nuanced, which means that you're going to hopefully be able to better mitigate against negative downside side effects of medication that you might be getting prescribed by a doctor. So that's just in healthcare alone. Then there's in transportation, where AI helps work with computer vision to help like a Tesla figure out what's on the road. It's a technology like anything else that is flawed, but it is working and improving. But if we're able to improve that technology substantially, that means that we can drastically improve the safety of our cars on the road, which means less road fatalities, which has been always a lingering issue for the United States. I think that that's something that can't be understated. That's something that's really promising. And then kind of like what we said at the outset with education, where AI can transform education. It is going to be a personalized tutor for your kid. And I think the important thing about that, too, is that it's not going to just simply tell you whether you're right or wrong, but it's going to tell you how you are wrong. And it's going to walk you through how to get to right, as opposed to just saying the binary right or wrong, which I think from an educational, like structural standpoint, is a little bit different than the status quo right now. And that is something that can't be understated. So there are many industries. In the legal industry, like I said, it's going to work with streamlining compliance with certain aspects of things. Where for financials, it's going to be able to do a better job of analyzing financial documents and understanding what exactly the companies are saying. We're seeing that with certain iterations of ChatGPT-4 and these companies on a business-to-business level. So I think that there's a lot of promising things there. And it has me so excited. It will increase worker productivity, which means that we will have more free time. I think that we can really stand the gain from leveraging this technology to the fullest. But the best way we can do that is if we ensure that it has an environment where it is supported and not stifled. And, you know, that's what keeps me up at night. It's like, can we go and make sure that we don't go down the wrong path here? You know, because that future is so bright and it is something that I will fight for every day. It's why I love doing the work I do, because I look at the world and I see how technology can be a positive force for good, that it can really go and be a conduit for changing things for the better. Again, like, I know people don't like social media right now on average, but a lot of people do like, let's say, supporting Ukraine in the war against Russia. And I can't help but note that social media played a very critical role in informing the general public about what was going down there in rapid fashion and really undermining the positions and the statements that were being made as that stuff was kicking off. I think you can't make that up. In Iran, you have social media helping highlight women that are protesting the authoritarian regime there. I think that is incredible stuff. That wouldn't happen in a world without it. And with AI, again, it's just another opportunity for us to go and develop some things and really enhance, I think, everybody across the globe, not just in the United States. There are reports that suggest that AI will go and raise global GDP by 7%. And for the record, 1% of that would be in the United States alone, which is about $250-ish billion, depending on what the current GDP numbers are. So it is substantial economic, you know, incentives for the United States. And that's just the bare minimum. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity here. And that has me so excited.
I am excited for the future, too. I think how I'm using it in my own life, it's been a tremendous blessing. I think it is a blessing for a lot of people. Maybe some of those people are being quiet because I've seen outrage on Twitter. Like, some guy uses some art for his, and it, you can tell it's AI because, like, it has two thumbs on one hand kind of thing.
But
and they're, everyone goes down, it's hard, but I'm like, it's still incredible. Like, yeah, the thumbs are screwed up, but just think about it. You know, you put in words, and out came a picture. And for me, you know, if I'm working on a project, and before ChatGPT and OpenAI and these programs, it's like you have to go out there, you have to find, because I can't draw like a stick figure. I can't even do a correct circle. They're always kind of wobbly. I'm just so bad. I'm so bad at that. So, but I, with my idiotic art skills, the only way I could do is like get art either from Google, you know, get some free art, or to go out and pay someone.
Yeah.
And that's a long process. There's a back and forth. Sometimes that can take days, weeks. If I'm working on this, though, I'm disabled. I have a part-time job, but, you know, it's not a lot of money. I can go out and like, hey, I can make the art. I can work on myself. That's fantastic. And that's such a blessing to me. And I'm sure it's such a blessing to other people. And the future, it's like I saw the demo for Unreal Engine 5 and what they had for environmental and level design. And it's incredible. They could produce work that would have taken months with huge teams, a big company like Ubisoft.
Yeah.
Or Activision, and they could get it done almost instantaneously. I mean, this new world we are entering could be so amazing, so unlike anything we've seen before, any of the generations past.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want people tinkering with it too much or screwing it up, because I'm like, we're so close to like this amazing, almost science fiction world we dreamed of.
Yeah.
But I have such little hope in humanity stays. I'm like, they're going to mess this up somehow. I just know it.
No.
I just know it. I don't know how it's going to happen.
No. I think you're raising some fair points. And like, as a gamer, like I said, Unreal Engine 5, love it. But, you know, even on a more fundamental level within the game itself, you have this massive opportunity to even restructure how characters are interacting with you, NPCs are interacting with you in the open world, if AI is able to make it more aware as a character within that game, right? So that's always been a big thing. And we've started seeing that get tinkered in with like the Nemesis system in Shadow of War, where you know, the orc remembers you and what you've done if you haven't killed it, or if it kills you, it remembers how it did it and has different bonuses applied to it because it did it in those ways, right? Like, we are just scratching the surface here. So again, in all kinds of industries, I think that there is so much to really be excited for. And truly, I think that we stand to gain a lot by kind of letting it do its thing and leaning into what made us be the leaders in technology that we have been for the last 50 plus years. And that's always been a light touch approach to regulating these industries. Our Web 2.0 era would not have been nearly as successful as it is without that. So I think that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we need to remember as a theme here. It's like, America harder in the right ways.
Yeah, no, definitely. The tech and the stuff that we put out is the stuff most of the world wants. While China does have certain countries that likes their style, it's usually the governments there, it's not the people. And what people really desire is what we're developing. And with all the problems Silicon Valley has, all the horrible, awful people that sometimes are in these companies, what they produce, this tech culture we have, it's amazing. It's amazing. I'm glad I get to live in this age to see it, because it's an incredible thing to see.
Yeah, no, like I said, I agree with you. It's why I like doing my tech policy work. It's it kind of puts me in a position where I get to be at the forefront of so many fun conversations. Shortly after I joined AFP, like one of the first conversations I had was around the infrastructure bill that had dropped, and there were crypto provisions in there, right? And it was like, oh, well, what's this thing with crypto? Like, what do we think about crypto? And how should we talk about crypto? And, you know, talked about that. Talked about when I worked on regulatory sandboxes. Talked about Section 230. I've talked about antitrust. I've talked about artificial intelligence, autonomous vehicles, broadband. The options are kind of endless. And I think that that's what makes this space so much fun, in my opinion, is that I truly get to have a lot of conversations, a wide breadth of them. And truly, you know, I think it's one that has a lot of implications for our future. Technology is what is going to continue to shape our society in very key ways. And that's what makes it so much fun from my perspective to be, you know, part of the nexus of that conversation in all these different areas.
Nice. Now, I like listening to you talk about it. Where can people find more of your work if they want to read what you do or find you in social media?
Yeah, I would say best way to go and keep up with my musings on tech policy is through the great blue bird that is Twitter. And you can follow me there at JamesCZ19. But you can also go and look at my our website for AmericansForProsperity.org, which will go and keep you up to date with some of the things that I'm doing through the company there. And then I have the affiliation with an organization that we both know and love in Young Voices. And I've been a commentator with them for, can't believe it now, but 3.5 years. And, you know, they're a great organization. And if you go to their website, which is young-voices.org, I believe, you can go and see my contributor profile there and keep up with all the media hits that I do on tech, which are a lot. Last year, I think I kind of surprised everybody in the office because I had 56 media hits happen between TV, radio, and podcast. And nobody
That's
quite...
That's quite a bit. That's a lot.
Just a little, you know? but Voices played a big role in that. So, you know, obviously eternally grateful for them and would highly encourage your listeners to check them out if they're interested in getting a head start on their, you know, young professional career in policy and think tanks and things like that.
Definitely. Well, we are going to stop it here. Thank you to everyone that took the time to watch or listen to the show today. As James pointed out, the show was helped put together by Bain Books Publishing, an imprint of Simon Schuster, and of course, the wonderful people at Young Voices. The show wouldn't have been possible without the help from Sean, who helps me organize these interviews, and Chris Holowick, my wonderful editor. He makes me look so much more competent than I actually am. Thank you again, Chris, for all your hard work. Until next time, my friends, please keep geeking out. Thank you so much, James, for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it. You're very, very informed and you speak well on this stuff. So I learned something. I thank you for making the time to do this.
No, of course. Thank you for having me, man. Obviously, we've been following each other for a little bit, so it's nice to go and reach out and do that collaboration. So anytime you want to talk any tech issues, I'm always a Twitter DM away. Always happy to chat about any of it. So thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'll keep in mind. All right. Well, you have a nice rest of your day.
Yeah, you too.